part of what I want to deal with tonight, and when we deal with the whole phenomenon, again, of parenting, is that it's so easy for us to get wrapped up into the reality of responsibilities. So easy for us to get wrapped up in the reality of position, who we are, what we're to do, what our duty and what our obligation is. And what we tend to forget most is the embodiment of who we are, that we are people and we are flesh and blood. You know, for those of you who heard the sexuality thing yesterday, again, we talk about self-care and self-trust has to start first. If you cannot start at the core of your embodiment and being, then nothing else means anything. And that may sound like a simple, obvious message, but the reality is that people become so obsessed and so preoccupied and so concerned and so worried and so obsessed with their responsibilities and the world out there beyond them and their obligations that they have a real tendency to ignore and to forget what is absolutely central to their lives, and that is themselves. You know, especially in a world of Christian tradition, because Christianity itself, in its own denial of the sensuous personness, has always sought to give up yourself, you know, kind of be that suffering servant, to be the martyr, to pour out yourself for the sake of some ideal goal or value or belief, and to lose self. And what we have found down through the ages is that that has been kind of a curse of ignorance. That's a misinterpretation and a misjudgment. Even when Christ himself walked the earth, so much of the time, there were times when people would want and crowds would come to him, and he would get in the boat and say, let's go to the other side. But Master, there are people out here who need you. Let's go to the other side. But Master, come stay at my house tonight. No, I need to go up to the mountain and meditate. See, Christ had a deep sense of, unless he could be centered in his own embodiment and centered in his spirit and integrated in his belief and his value and his feeling, that he could not have done what he set out to do as a ministry. And this is one of the core revelations of our spirituality, and the way that it's important for us to understand it, that as human beings, whenever we're involved in anything that we do, we are people first. Perhaps the most central and crucial teaching of Christ in first blessing us as human beings and then acknowledging to us that in your human nature you have the power to overcome evil, you have the power to overcome pain, you have the power to overcome death itself. And that whole experience, you know, the whole Easter process from death to resurrection is a full and total expression of Christ conquering evil. For us as human beings, when we're out there in the work-a-day, live-a-day world, whether it's in relationships, whether it's with families, whether it's in jobs, and whether it's in working, we are perpetually exposed to the environment and the reality of living the death-resurrection process, being the embodiment of Christ crucified and Christ raised. But our ignorance has been a lack of awareness and a lack of sensitivity and a lack of capacity to know how to walk through the process on a daily basis. That's why the essence of grief and loss and understanding that phenomenon for us as persons is absolutely essential. We're having a miracle here. I'm being called. the spirits and the funds. Oh no, it's just Barbara and Jackie.
Powerful women,
yes. I think the significance of understanding this is that as we as human beings, when we choose to enter into life, you know, we come into life unaware of what we are exposed to. We don't know the nature of our parents. We come in the world totally dependent. We don't know what we are to believe and what we are to become. We come in naive and unconditionally loving, unconditionally trusting. And we are bound up and passed down through generations, all of the enculturation. In other words, we are taught the values and beliefs, not so much just by words, but by the behavior and the action that we experience in all of those years of early upbringing. And we formalize and we idealize, and in our rebelliousness, you know, we choose values, hopes, and dreams of how we are to become and what we want to do with our life. And human life and the whole process of human growth is a process. It's fraught with experience, and following that experience is the sensitivity of our bodiliness, of our consciousness, of our emotions, our sensitivity that tries to teach us the message of life. And so we begin to disbelieve our parents, and we become upset, and we're angry, and we're scared, and we're afraid, and we cry, and we're sad, and we're depressed, and we feel hurt and abandoned, and we're elated, and we're excited, and we're hopeful, and we're just filled with anticipation and, you know, energy up, energy down. Life is filled with that perpetual participation as we encounter the experience of life itself. The death-resurrection process is our capacity to become aware of that. Yet, we live in a culture that chooses to deny our experience. It's a culture that says, don't feel your feelings, put your best face forward. It's a culture that says big boys don't cry. You know, it's a culture that says be mysterious. It's a culture that says be seductive. It's a culture that says tell them what they want to hear. It's a culture that says be competitive. Lie if you need to. Make them believe whatever you want them to believe. It's a culture that says, don't air your dirty laundry. It's a culture that perpetually gives us the message of, don't listen to yourself, don't listen to your being, don't listen to your body. This is what's important for you. And if you choose, and if you want to be accepted, and if you want to be a success in life, then do what I tell you to do and ignore what's going on inside. Feelings are not appropriate. Don't walk around with a hangdog look on your face. Dry up those tears or I'll give you something to cry about. How many times have you heard those kind of messages? Stop playing and laughing too loud. You're bothering me. Not now. I'm busy. I haven't got time for that now. You don't need help. You can figure it out on your own. Is this all you did in school? Why did you get that D? Okay. We're a culture that tends to focus on negative affirmation, a culture that tends to focus on what's wrong. So the message that we perpetually take into ourselves is a message of inadequacy, a sense of worthlessness, a fear of rejection, and a fear of abandonment. But still, we forge ahead. We forge ahead with hopes and dreams that someday when we grow up, we'll be successful. We'll find somebody, Mr. Right or Miss Right. We'll fall in love. And then we'll settle down and get married and raise babies and live happily ever after. See, but if you're a being and a child and a person who has that pain and that suffering inside. But you're out there trying to slug it out, and you're out there trying to act the act, play the part, and do the thing. The reality that happens is when you get out there in the world of marriage, when you get out there in the world of parenting, in that kind of intense human drama, where you are being and living and eating and breathing and emoting with somebody 24 hours a day, all of your human vulnerability will expose itself. Every limit you have ever had will show itself. Every shortness, every pain, every fear, every anxiety, every guilt, every shame, every inadequacy, everything that's a part of you as a human being exposes itself. You cannot live that intensely close with another human being and not be exposed and not share that. See, but where is our process to help us, to nurture us, and to guide us through? See, we don't have process. We aren't taught those things. We're taught the goals and the dreams and what we should become. But nobody teaches us how to step through the path. So what happens to us as people is that we get frozen and we get locked and we get lost. And this is a core of understanding death, resurrection, and grief. Christ, in his suffering, you know, experienced that torment and that pain and the torture and the hurt. You know, there are now people, historians, who look back and say that they think that Christ in the Garden of Gethsemane had a heart attack. And he suffered for those days. You know, because they talk about in Scripture where the lance pierced and there was water and blood that came out. They said the agony may have been so literal that what Christ died of was a broken heart. Literally, a broken heart. A deep sense of agony and personal suffering. But again, what happens is, what happens if a person stays stuck and tries to deny it? And this is what happens to us as human beings. When we began to talk about loss and grief is a natural phenomenon. Every human being suffers. Every human being ends, finishes, loses, gets cut off, walked away from, hurt, betrayed, abandoned, rejected. And whenever something comes at you in that kind of painful experience, that emotion goes into you physically. My loss and grief is not just that I lost the relationship, it means that a part of me has been severed. A part of me has been broken. A part of me has been abused. A part of me has been neglected. A part of me has been rejected. And that I am feeling a physical loss of energy. Now what tends to happen is that there are natural phenomena in the human experience. One of the first phenomena that happens in the grief process is that the person literally goes into shock. Shock is characterized by disbelief, by a deep sense of denial. This isn't really happening to me. It's not as bad as all that. I know we can work it out. You know, what happens to the person is they literally get numb inside of themselves. They're kind of zombies going through the daily routines because you just can't function. You just don't know. It's just such a horrendous. And when you talk about things like marriages breaking up or fights or abuse, or significant devastating events that tend to happen in family, when it's that profound level of shock, it's like a mega jolt into the body. You know, the body takes this whack into the body. And your body has to go numb. when you experience that kind of trauma and pain. So in that numbness, in that denial, in that disbelief, we often just simply kind of go through the process of trying to go day to day, not thinking real clearly, just kind of going straight ahead and trying to pretend. And oftentimes what you find, a person in denial, a person in shock, that even though they've experienced this event, they walk around as if nothing ever happened. They rationalize, they make excuses, okay? they try to support or pretend that those kind of things really aren't happening to me, it's not as bad as all that. There are 1,001 different ways and different reasons that people, and it's a lot has to do with the shock and the self-denial. Now when we become stuck in our shock and self-denial, all of that energy that went into us stays frozen. And what we literally need to do is we begin to really push everything down. Physically push everything down. What you often will begin to experience at this point is that the person will begin to do a range of different kind of compulsive behaviors as a way to cope. So they might start eating. Or if they can't eat, what they might do is they might start drinking a little more. Or they might go shopping. Or they might really get involved with cleaning the house. You know, if I keep the house clean, keep myself busy. In other words, what happens is people begin to compulsively look for ways to fill up the time and energy to avoid the horror and the suffering and the pain that go deep inside of themselves. And many people get stuck in this level of grief because when you get involved in a compulsive behavior, it's very easy to literally lose control over yourself. People who have eating disorders, many times rather than feeling feelings, they just feel hungry. They start craving. People who use alcohol or chemicals simply medicate. Every time they start to feel the pain and the grief in their body, rather than knowing how to respond and deal with the grief in their body, the tendency is, I want to use something to medicate the grief. And they get into a compulsive cycle because as soon as the medication wears off, the grief comes back. So they need more medication to go. And they get caught in this cycle. And more often than not, these kind of compulsive behaviors will turn into full-blown addictions, where the person literally begins to lose control over themselves. It's not enough, for example, in working in the addiction field, the first step in an addiction is to help a person to address the addiction as an addiction so they can achieve some level of abstinence. But just being abstinent from that addiction is not enough. If the person is to maintain any level of long-term recovery, eventually what they're going to have to do is they're going to have to get into their grief. What are the core issues that are buried deep inside? Second level, and when I talk about this level of grief, people can go through any of those different levels of grief. The second level tends to be anger. Eventually, when I experience this trauma, this shock, this pain, and this suffering in my life, after the shock begins to wear off, there is often followed by periods of intense rage and anger. And the anger can be turned a number of ways. It can be turned inward or it can be turned outward. But what literally begins to happen is that this person begins to have lots of agitating behaviors. And they begin to really feel agitated. They begin to really be emotionally out of control. They begin to resent things, resent the environment, resent work, resent getting up, resent responsibility, resent the kids, resent each other. Oftentimes there's a tremendous amount of revenge, thoughts of revenge. Many of the types of anger, there's a lot of external anger that often happens is that tend to become verbally abusive, cynical, critical, bitter, judgmental, righteous. Okay. And part of what's happening is I'm trying to lash out. I've got all this energy going on inside and I'm trying to throw it out. And I'm not dealing with it and owning it as something deeper inside of myself, but I get stuck in a process of throwing it out, and I tend to throw it out at the people. And it's not unusual that it happens, you know, that this kind of stuff ends up happening to the people closest to you. It may be in physically abusive behaviors. Sometimes what you begin to see with this is that I take my revenge and anger out on myself. And so what I begin to do is break the values. So a person might go out and find somebody to have an affair with, become sexually promiscuous, say screw it to this or screw it to that, and just go out and do something outlandish, out of the ordinary, jeopardize themselves. These behaviors are usually characterized by irrationality and out of controlness. It's not unusual that agitation increases itself, so you find yourself short at work, short with people you're close to, angry at the kids, angry at bosses, angry at your body. It's real easy out of a sense of anger just to go out and violate yourself. You know, it's kind of say like if you want to do it, I've had it with this, I'm going to go out and get drunk and just do myself in. And just go out and get on your lips and face and pay for it the next morning out of a sense of revenge or rage. Many times people get so out of control in terms of their physicalness, they can literally go into blackouts. That the anger, the rage turns to such a level of intensity that they become consciously shut off from their rage and out of control with their behavior. This level of anger is very self-destructive and defeating. It's a natural part of grief, and it's a sign of grief. There is something much deeper that needs to happen with people, but if they choose not to do those kinds of things, then what begins to happen is that people easily get stuck in that, and that becomes their bent. And if you get stuck in learning in your own grief process, you don't know how to do this, then any time you would go into any kind of intimate relationship, when things begin to get tough and stuck in the family, what happens is you get stuck in that level of grief, and you're never able to step behind it, beyond it. So what happens is cyclically, from relationship to relationship to relationship, you end up treating everybody that way. If you lived in a parent system where your parents were stuck in that kind of level of grief, were never able to resolve it. If you lived in a family where a parent was stuck with rage and anger, every time things got to a point where he couldn't handle it or she couldn't handle it, they would explode in rage and anger, then you would find yourself, when you get in situations where you come to a level of insecurity or out of controlness or unsureness, you'll find yourself reacting in the same kind of behaviors. It's a learned pattern of behavior because nobody has ever taught you how to go beyond, how to get deeper. The third level, called bargaining. Bargaining is a kind of way of trying to make it better. Let's see if I can compensate. Oftentimes bargaining is followed by if there is a tremendous amount of revenge or rage and anger, that's often followed by a lot of guilt. And when I feel guilty or shameful about my behavior, what then begins to happen is a try to following up of, let's see what I can do to make up for it. I really didn't intend it. I'm so sorry. I feel really lousy about what I did to you. So what happens is the person goes out of control. What often happens, for example, in divorce or single parent families is that if there's an explosion or some deep expression of pain, many times one of the parents will respond to the other person, to one of the children, by saying, "Oh, I'm sorry, what can I do to make it up to you?" And so what happens is you get this outpouring of love, or you get this outpouring of gifts, or outpouring of money, or outpouring of, sure, whatever you want to do, the rules don't apply anymore. You know, do your own thing because I know you're really sad. And it's not unusual for parents to grieve and feel guilty in their own grief, so they grieve for the children and they get real enmeshed. And what tends to happen then is that the parent can't separate the child's grief from their own grief. And the parent gets real enmeshed. And this is a part of, when we talk about a lot of codependent behavior. Codependency means dependency with, that I react to somebody else's behavior. I feel responsible and I'm always preoccupied. So rather than dealing with my stuff, I get worried about what so-and-so is doing. And every time so-and-so does something, then I do everything possible to try to compensate and make their pain go away. See, but think about it for a moment. If you were hurting a little bit and somebody was just smothering you with love and concern about your hurting, what would that do to your guts deep inside? What kind of feeling would that generate inside of you? You were just trying to share some healthy grief and sadness, and somebody comes over and says, "Oh, don't cry. Don't cry. You know, what can I do for you? You want to go to the show or something?" Say, what happens to you when you're just trying to feel a feeling when somebody comes over?
I would get angry.
You get angry? Feel real resentful.
Tell them to get lost.
Well, it's not right here, too.
Well, you're repressing, you don't know how to
right. See, a lot of what happens in bargaining is that there's a tremendous discounting. That if I'm just trying to grieve my natural grief and somebody comes over and tries to compensate for my grief or wipe away my tears or tell me everything is going to be all right. See, it's like, you know, part of your response is natural. It's like, no, it's not all right. I'm sad, you know, I'm mad. And I got a right to be mad, so don't try to take away my mad from me. It's one of the things that parents do on a regular basis, like one of the difficulties in child rearing is like when kids throw tantrums. Tantrums are healthy. The only thing a parent needs to do is get everything out of the way so that the kid doesn't do anything to hurt themselves and then let them flop around. Teaches them a healthy focus of anger. But many times what happens is the parents don't know what to do because they don't know how to deal with a temper tantrum. So what the parents do will punish the kid for having a temper tantrum. You can't do that, and they'll pick him up and spank him. Or they get in there and stop it, shake him. And what's going on is more the parents' issue in terms of, I'm scared to death because I don't know what the hell's going on. What do you do with the little kids that's flopping around all over the floor, screaming and yelling and holding their breath? And, you know, and in reality, what's going on is the kid's mad. You know, it's pretty clear. You know, kids do it very basically. And that's a healthy phenomenon. But what happens often is that we project. Oftentimes in separation, especially when you have the parent who's the long distance parent, if they have short-term visitation rights, that many times there's a real sense of competition that begins to happen between the parents who are separated from one another. So there's a game that often gets played of what's going on at home, kind of fill me in on what's going on, what's mom been doing for you? So I'll do it a little bit better so you'll like it over here. Whatever your rules were when I was there at home, they don't apply here. I'll spend many money on you, I'll entertain you, I'll make sure that you're going to be just here for 2 days, we'll have a grand time together. See, and what happens is the kid never experiences reality because that parent is so stuck in their grief. And then what that tends to follow in is a lot of resentful rage and anger that. Because then, what happens if one parent is left, hasn't got a job yet, is living on a tight budget, and the other one's out there pouring big bucks into this kid, then you begin to get into this competition of, there's no way that I can do that, and what do I do when I get a kid back after a weekend who's totally out of control because they have no boundaries? you know, set on them. So that's kind of grief, and what's really going on is the unresolved grief and rage and anger between those parents, and the kids get stuck in the middle in that process. And we get real caught up in this bargaining process. We get real caught up in do-gooding, going out of our way, denying ourselves. Oftentimes parents feel shamed and guilty, so they stopped having a social life, stay home all the time. You know, my kids have got it hard, I have to go to work all day, so I feel guilty about if I need to go out in the evening or go to a meeting or do something like that, so I should just stay home. The first time a kid complains with an ache or pain, the parent feels guilty and responsible. It's because I'm not there for them. That never used to happen when I was home all the time. Okay. Touching some feelings. Yeah, and as I go through some of this process, I want you to be aware that if you touch feelings, feelings are acceptable. It's all right for you to feel that intensity and that power within yourself. It's real healthy. The fourth stage of grief is depression. Depression is often categorized as a loss of spirit, a loss of hope. Loss of hope, feeling of powerlessness, that all of that energy, kind of feeling of inadequacy, so it's characterized by withdrawal, isolation, often the depressed person, when their body gets depressed, it's repressed inside, then their immune systems begin to shut down, and so you see this person begin to experience a lot of illness, psychosomatic illnesses, headaches, neck aches, back aches, stomach aches, colds, flu, become accident prone, the loss of desire, loss of interest, start giving up things that were important to them in the past. See, all of those kinds of behaviors are a characteristic of depression, and depression is a simple phenomenon. It literally means my energy is depressed. It's pushed so deep down that I don't have the energy. As often said, I mentioned this yesterday in the sexuality thing, but a normal person who's healthy and whose body is functioning normally only takes 20% of their energy to just simply survive, for their body to do its normal functioning, which means they have 80% of their energy for creativity and expression. A depressed person, a person who is locked and frozen in their grief, consumes almost 80% of their energy just to get through a day, which leaves them very little energy to go out and be creative in the world. So depression is a real difficult state. We tend to real turn in on ourselves. Oftentimes a part of depression is suicidal, a real sense of impotence, physical impotence, sexual impotence, relational impotence, a loss of faith in self, loss of interest and desire, how to get out. Now these stages of depression are patterns that people can go in and out of. And it's because of our lack as humanity to be able to know how to get through the process of depression that we tend to get really caught up in these kind of behaviors. Really cycle back and through again, get depressed, then get angry, try to build ourselves back out and get out there and do it, fall into a pattern of compulsive behaviors, fail at something, get depressed again, try to build ourselves up and go somewhere else and start all over again. See, and the point is that, you know, we try geographical solutions. Maybe if we move somewhere, we can start all over again. Maybe if we try a different partner, and start it all over again. Let's get a book at a self-help store, and maybe if we read it, and we'll do that one, and we'll start, you know, maybe there's the, and we're perpetually looking for the answer outside. And in reality, what we're saying to ourselves is that we're powerless and immobilized inside, that we don't have the energy, and we don't have the desire. Now, before I go to the second part of this, I'd like to hear kind of your responses to this. How do you see this? And again, I talk about, I offer a structure here. How can you see this happening in your own lives?
A lot.
Yeah, that's a good answer. Be aware of, because I want you to be aware of, it's like your behaviors, when you can acknowledge how you see this process functioning in your life. See, that's the first key. The first key in recovery is identification. The ability to name your own behavior. The ability to acknowledge that, yes, in fact, I am depressed. I am grieving. I am hurting. I am suffering. I am in pain. Share with me, what do you see as your own self?
In terms of depression, for me, it's reached a state where it seems like I can't do anything about it, or I don't have control over it.
So the sense of loss of control?
Yeah,
kind of a,
that you're trying, or it's not really.
And hopeless and powerless, because I've tried everything I know how to do, and I'm still...
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
Depression and anger. So you see yourself bound. How do you see yourself? How do you do anger? How do you get stuck in the cycle of that kind of anger?
I used to go into rages.
In rages. And then how would that, what would happen when you followed that?
After rages, there would be guilt and depression.
So rage, guilt, and depression.
And then back to rage.
And then it would cycle itself. Yeah.
I just went through an interesting cycle of that last week with a friend of mine. Probably didn't realize that I was just under so much stress and pressure that I was reacting quite normally, but I was shocked at my own behavior. Getting very angry, which is not typical of me, getting very angry with somebody that I love and respect a lot. Writing a very angry letter and then on the flip side of that, becoming very self-righteous. Almost in the same letter. But and then a few days later, finding myself writing a letter of, I'm so sorry that I hurt you and I said all these things, but it was clear on the other side. But then a few more days went by and a third letter, which came to, well, this is what I was really feeling. And I realized now I was really confused and feeling a lot of stress and a lot of pressure. Maybe that was a healthy outcome, I'm not sure. But I sure did with step two and three. Mm-hmm. And I guess I'm kind of wondering, was the last letter that I wrote saying, well, I really did need to say some things to you, and it wasn't quite the, I'm sorry to say, but I really needed to say these things.
All right. Good, thank you.
Was that...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I want to talk about that in a minute.
With anger, I like to chop wood because it gets a lot of my anger out. Mm-hmm. I don't know, it's too real physical, and of course, but it's useful. It's perfect. It's got a purpose. Mm-hmm. Got two purposes. Mm-hmm.
What do other people see as a part of their frozen grief?
I identify with the parent guilt. Sometimes I get really angry at something, and it was the straw that broke the camel's back, something my daughter said or did or didn't do. It's not, and the anger is not appropriate for what happened. And then I feel really badly. And I know I try to make it up, you know, to her. And then I think I do deal with the depression off and on. I mean, I identify with the neck aches, the cold, the flu. Getting up in the morning thinking, oh, I don't want to take care of today. I'm just going to forget it. And I get up and I go, but it's slower every morning, and that comes and goes.
I do a lot of blaming when I get angry.
Blaming?
And especially inside my mind.
So get real righteous and focused out there, real critical about what everything is going on out there. That's
not depressed. I wonder how I could ever get depressed. I mean, how would I ever get that way? Because I think, oh, well, I won't be depressed. But then when you get there, then it is hard to get out of that trough.
Yeah. Part of the denial.
Mm-hmm. I've been through all four of those quite a bit. It seems like they come back as a vicious wheel.
Right.
And feel the different levels coming on. And the first two, the first one, the shock is over. The anger is the, I have to keep busy. I have to keep going. I have to keep moving. The guilt, I go through a lot of guilt. Basically, I feel guilty about being here right now. And they're back over there where I'm getting calm and they're angry. And the depression is the worst one. The depressed, you feel it coming, and there's nothing I can do to get rid of it, it seems like, unless I can really get myself on a high, hold out, buy myself a shirt, make myself feel good, maybe something like that, but other than that.
So a way to deal with depression is go out and buy stuff that you can. Mm-hmm.
When I get mad, and I usually don't have anyone to blame it on. It's either not their fault, or I don't allow myself to blame the same. It's not your fault when it is sometimes. I usually don't have a source for my anger, and that even makes me angrier sometimes. And I keep it inside of me a lot. Like we were talking about the clenched fist. I keep everything inside of me.
Sometimes I think I become obsessed with my anger. And I think I can get to the point where I'm addicted to that, because then I don't have to look underneath it.
Right.
It's like, I'm angry. I don't want to do anything about
it. Anger is a familiar place to be, and I don't know how to get at what else is there. So anger is the emotion that I can. I can let that one come out and be there with anger, but not go anywhere else with it.
With the compulsive, I notice in myself that I will do compulsive things that the other person would not like, that I would like, but they wouldn't allow, or say, no, you won't do that. And so I do it anyway. The compulsion to just do something that the other person would not approve of in any way.
I have a dumb little technical question. How do they figure, how can you determine that 20 or 80% of a person's energy is going towards survival? I think like a 9.5.
Now, what they've done is they've done studies where they've tried to put down both bioenergetically in terms of biorhythms, where people are in different states of their process of going through recovery, and they've done comparative studies that way, and they've also done studies in terms of attitude, energy, accomplishments, goals and dreams, you know, kind of normal behavior levels, and what a person does when they fall deeply into things and when they get into recovery, and they find that people tend to drop off by that kind of percentage in terms of like one of the studies, this study came initially. Now, this was done initially in a fat clinic, in a fat hospital, in a fat farm. You know, that people in a fat farm were talking about when people were considered obese or overweight, they began to look at, well, what kind of things did you do when you were at a normal or healthy body weight and what do you do now? And they began to also follow them through the day and structure that, and they found that people were intensely overweight, lost four times as much of their creative energy because it took that much energy for them, for their bodies just to carry all of that extra weight. And then other people began to pick up those studies and say, well, that applies to these other levels and these other behaviors as well. Yeah, how many of you, for myself, one of the things that I discovered about myself, I used to run around and say that I was never depressed, never angry, and I went to counselors and they say, oh, you're really pissed. I said, no, I'm not. And for me, a part of it was, is that the way that my anger, see, anger either goes out in an expression or it goes in, and what I tended to do for myself was eat. Because I grew up in an Italian family, and that was my mother's way of coping with her stress, was put food on the table. So I used to fluctuate in weight by 50 pounds at a time. And my depressions tended to last over 6 months until I could get motivated enough to lose the weight, and then my energy would come back up. And, you know, now it's only about a 10-pound fluctuation, so I'm able to see that that's another part of it is do-gooding. You know, when I got real depressed, and then I didn't see any worth in myself, so I just go out there and automatically work myself to death and ignore my own wants and needs. I'd stop doing the things that are important to me. I wouldn't run, I wouldn't exercise, I wouldn't take time for myself. I would just sit and zone out on the boob tube, and I stopped going to church because it was just too hard to get up in the morning. It was easy to just start talking myself out of things that were important parts of who I am as a person. So there are lots of little subtle ways that you can begin to recognize, and it's important to learn how to identify those things inside of yourself. So you recognize, and it's the only way you can begin to understand that I am grieving. Yeah.
Wondering about sleeping disorders, because sometimes I've had it where you wake up early and they have an explanation like that.
Yeah, that's usually a sign of depression when a person has insomnia, can't sleep, or they're tired all the time and they have to nap. And a lot of people, when they're upset about stuff, simply go to bed, because they're really lost and kind of don't have the energy to go deal with the issues. You what? Take showers, did I hear somebody say? Yeah, that's part of the obsession. A lot of times
they're hot showers.
Part of what I want you to experience and see with this is that this is the cycle of normal human behavior, and it's amazing if you really get to understand this, you recognize that this is the pattern where so many people, especially in relationships, stay stuck. That it's normal in every human relationship that we will experience a crisis in our relationship, a level of discomfort, disbelief, disagreement, anger, resentment, conflict, pain. And that if we are never taught healthy ways of being able to go through those kinds of conflicts or relationships, what happens is that we literally get into the energy in our body and we are no longer rationally thinking. And we become out of control and we get reactive and we literally get controlled by this behavior. There's an old adage in people who do anger management work to say, if you don't learn to deal with your anger, then your anger will deal with you. If you can't be clear and constructive and know what's healthy with anger, then your anger comes out sideways. And it's usually out of control and usually self-destructive or destructive to the people or the environment that you care about the most. See, this energy is literally a physical phenomenon. And if you don't deal with it, the physical phenomenon will deal with you, whether it breaks your body in sickness and in pain, depresses your energy and spirit, or becomes enraged and out of control and explosive. and you literally have no control over it. That's why grief is absolutely essential. That was the process in terms of Christ that nobody understood. Everybody wanted Christ to be God King and come and wipe out the enemies of Israel and wanted Christ to raise to this golden throne and be the ruler of the world. And Christ said, no, that's not the way it works. I'll die and I will suffer for you, and that's how I will conquer it, because I will be raised again. And when Christ challenges everybody else to that, everybody else says, well, wait a minute. You're supposed to teach me how to get on top of stuff, not how to suffer through it. Teach me how to get over it, or get around it, or go under it, but don't ask me to go through it. And that's the human dilemma. The human dilemma is that when we experience the naturalness of our human turmoil, we're in the process of going through it. But if we don't know how to go through it in a healthy way, we get stuck in it, and that's where we die. It's where relationships die, families die, people die. It's a deadly serious phenomenon. Now, what do we do with this? Where do we go? Kubler-Ross talks about the fifth stage as being the stage of acceptance. Now, acceptance is an easy word to say, but the reality of it is that it is very painful, difficult, and hard work. Acceptance first means that I have to acknowledge that this exists. It means I have to be able to acknowledge honestly my feelings and my sensitivity. When we have a denial and a culture that says, don't feel your feelings, for you to learn to accept your feelings is an unusual phenomenon because it's not a widely practiced phenomenon. Feelings. What are feelings? There are four basic fundamental feelings. Glad, mad, sad, scared. Almost all emotions can be toned down to this level. Acceptance means the capacity to know how to identify and acknowledge feelings. Now, for many of us, the bargaining process is we think we're in grief, but we think we're in grief because we've lost the relationship or something has changed in our life. And that's not the reality. That may have been a precipitating event, but the true reality is that the grief is my grief and for me. It's not for the relationship. It's not for spouse. It's not for the kids. It's not for my parents. It's for me. That it is my dream. It is my belief. It is my illusions that have been lost. My sadness, my anger, and my fear are mine. And that's one of the devastations or one of the difficulties in our culture, is that a lot of people, when they grieve, they tend to focus the grief out there. Well, it's because he was a jerk to me. Or it's because she didn't do this. Or they won't do that. Or I can't get this accomplished. Or they won't blah, blah, blah. And we have a real tendency to want to put a lot of energy out on externals rather than owning that my sadness is mine. For me to accept it means first that I have to own it. Own it means I accept it for me. That it is my body trying to teach me that my choices, my behaviors, my values, and my belief are what is killing me. My anger and rage may be precipitated by an event, but what it often points to is a deep sense of inadequacy or fear within myself. I don't know how to deal with this situation. I don't know how to respond in healthy and clear ways. So I react in anger. Or my anger and rage may point to the deep sense of abandonment. I feel cheated or betrayed. I deserved, I wanted, I needed, I expected to get this. This is what I wanted in a relationship and it didn't happen. And I feel hurt, and I feel torn, and I feel lost and desperate and scared and lonely. And it's a recognition that a lot of times what the grief in a relationship is that we give ourselves, and we give of ourselves in that relationship. And what we lose in that relationship is ourself. When we begin to own the grief, then we begin to have to working through it. Part of working through it is I need to do my grief work, okay? What that means is that I have to experience some kind of emotional catharsis. An emotional catharsis means if somebody punches me in the gut, it doesn't mean that I say, ouch. Means that I give myself permission to double up in pain and fall on the floor and cry my eyes out because it hurts. The tendency in our culture is when somebody gets hurt, somebody says, are you all right? What's wrong? What's our first response back? I'm okay. What's wrong? Nothing. You know, did such and so hit you? No. No, they didn't mean it. It was an accident. You know, it didn't work out this way. Well, why would they go out and have an affair on you? Aren't you mad? Well, of course I'm mad. I'm upset. But I mean, I've got to be strong for the kids. You know, I mean, it's all right for him to be a jerk, but it's not okay for me to be, okay? And what we begin to do with that is that we really literally minimize and put it away. We need a safe place. We have a right to all of those feelings, and we can't avoid it. You can't experience a phenomenon like death of a spouse, divorce, abuse, separation, loss. You can't experience that kind of phenomenon and not have rage and hate and hurt and suffering and terror and fear inside of you. And what happens to people is that if we try to deny and stuff that down and avoid it, then that part of it literally controls us. It controls us in the way we're not going to be as intimate, and we're not going to be close, and we're not going to be healthy in knowing how to choose other healthy relationships because we're too numb. So we have to cathart. The power, the conversion, and ultimately the level of letting go healing. That process begins when I am able to experience the full passion of my grief. And that's what Christ did on the cross. I am willing to take it all and experience it all, because only then can I transform the energy within myself. I can use that passion, I can use that power to say for myself, something's not right in my environment. I don't deserve to feel this way. I don't need to have things happen to me this way. I have to move myself in a different direction. I need support. See, but until you make the decision down here, a lot of people, see, and this is a part of our minimizing and denial, a lot of people say, well, yeah, this didn't work out, and this isn't going right in our family, but I think if I just found the answer, you know, if I just found the answer, if I just did it this way, maybe it'll work. Or, well, this one didn't work, but that's not all that bad, and I just got to pull myself up by the bootstraps and get out there. And a lot of us, See, our frozen grief is we got like this thing around our neck, and we're trying to resolve life from here up. And from here up, mind, intellect, and thought, without the power of passion and sensitivity, is invalid. It's irrational. It's illusional. You cannot make decisions based on just mind. A true level of shifting of life, changing of energy, of getting unstuck in life, means that that decision has to come from the core of my guts. It has to come from the power of my passion and grief. So it means I have to listen to the grief, I have to allow the grief, and I have to experience the grief in healthy ways. Now that's another one. What's healthy grief? As opposed to all this garbage. Healthy grief is the ability to own, to name, and to physically experience. It means being in a place where I can be safe, being sometimes with a guide who can structure me, why the use of therapy to do grief work, to do family work, you know, to do marriage work, to do resolution on family of origin stuff, things from the past, to do the grief of victimization of abuse, to do, you know, to learn how to get unstuck in anger, to learn how to adapt to being a single parent or to be a single family. All of anything that involves transition involves grief. And if I am to come through it in a healthy way, I have to first be able to acknowledge and validate my grief. There are structures and healthy ways to do anger beyond exploding it outward or taking it all inward. There are groups, and that's a part of knowing what a support community can be. People not who try to give me answers, or people who tell me it's okay, or people who want to come and hug my tears out of me. It's more a way of saying, where is there an environment where I can just acknowledge the full intensity and power of my grief? For many people, the reason they get stuck is that the fear of losing control, the fear of losing control in anger or in rage, is the same as the fear of death. We're afraid that if I really let loose, I'll never stop. I'll be a maniac. And so the terror and fear of losing it, of getting out of control, immobilizes a lot of us. That's why it's important to be able to have healthy structure, to know that I can experience the full power of my rage and pain and grief, while at the same time stay in control. Know that I'm not going to do damage to myself or anybody else. And until I experience going through it and finding out that it stops, finding out that it will have an end to it, and finding out that nobody gets hurt and I didn't die because I allowed it to happen. So therapy is one alternative to doing grief. Having a place, having a support system, getting involved in support systems, you know, like support systems, kind of Henry Nouwen's concept of the wounded healer, kind of the great rise of things, you know, separated and divorced groups that tend to happen out there in some church communities, where you can be with people who won't know and understand, and they can hear, and they're not surprised by the things that you have to say. You know, by being in a lot of the different kind of 12-step groups, that's a lot why, like AA, for example, for alcoholics, or NA for chemical addicts, becomes an important support system, because a person can allow themselves to cathart and deal that, and people don't get shocked or run out of the room because people have heard the story before. It's happened, and it's important to be able to share it. The axiom as always is, pain shared is pain divided. See, what's devastating is to carry the secret around inside and have nowhere to go with it and be immobilized and eaten up by it. It needs to be shared.